Keeping Democracy Alive with Bert Cohen.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Well, there has been some familiarity today in 2015 about who Billie Holiday was. Her birthday was noted widely on April 7th. Fewer people today know about much of what happened to Julius and Ethel Rosenberg in the time of the communist hysteria in the early 1950s. 2015 is significant for both Billie Holiday and Ethel Rosenberg, the birth mother of our guest today, Robert Meeropol. Are you there, Robert?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, thanks for being with us. Both women would have celebrated their 100th birthday this year. Billie Holiday was an amazing jazz and blues singer who died tragically in 1959. She died at age 44 and certainly influenced people like Janis Joplin and Amy Winehouse. She's become the very archetype of both the glorious, strong-willed diva and a too early death. Our other tragic American story involves Ethel Rosenberg, who at age 37, along with her husband Julius, was executed in the barbaric electric chair in a very high-profile case back in 1953 when our guest, their son Robert, was just 6 years old. Today on Keeping Democracy Alive, we're going to talk about some of the perhaps surprising parallels in their lives and the place of their lives, not only in American history, but more importantly, in current political and racial realities. For example, as our guest writes, Billie and Ethel had similar talents and defied similar enemies. Both died prematurely, victimized by law enforcement. In 2015, the centennial year of both of their births, we remember Billie Holiday for singing about lynching, and we remember Ethel Rosenberg for being legally lynched. Again, Robert Meeropol, thanks very much for being with us. He is not only the son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, he started something really amazing called the Rosenberg Fund for Children, and we will certainly get into that. It's a great organization. For those who may not be all that familiar with the subjects, Robert, if you can tell us what happened to your birth parents, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, when you were just six.
Okay, well, it really started when I was three, in that when I was 3 years old in 1950, they were both arrested. Ethel and Julius were both arrested and charged with conspiring to steal what was called the secret of the atomic bomb and give it to the Soviet Union. They were charged with doing this in 1945 at the end of World War II, and they were tried in 1951, after their 1950 arrest, for conspiring to steal the secret of the atomic bomb. And they did this at the height of the Cold War. So when they were charged with stealing the secret was when we were allied with the Soviet Union,
right,
during World War II, but they were tried when we were, you know, engaged in real hostilities, and war was raging in Korea at that time as well. And they were found guilty and sentenced to death and executed on June 19th, 1953, when I was just after my sixth birthday, basically. That's the basic facts of the case. I can summarize what we now know about it today, and this is one of the surprising things about the Rosenberg case, in part because of how much interest it generated. It was considered, J. Edgar Hoover called it the crime of the century. J. Edgar Hoover was the head of the FBI during this period. And it was the biggest case of its time. And so there was a lot written about it. But also my brother and me, we both got involved in a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit when we grew up in an effort to expose what was done to them. And this forced the release of over 300,000 previously secret government files on the case. And more recently, files have the recordings or the transcriptions of what took place before the grand jury was released to the public, and these things are usually kept secret forever, but in this case, they were released. And there's been material released from the former Soviet Union. So the bottom line is that we know a surprising amount about the prosecution of my parents and what went on behind the scenes. And so we are able to determine at this point that, yes, Julius Rosenberg was involved with a bunch of young people. These were people who were very young, some as early as their late teens. Wow. Most of the activity occurred when people were in their 20s, and they were involved, Julius was involved in providing the Soviet Union with military and industrial information, initially to help it defeat Hitler during World War II. And we now know with a great deal of certainty that Ethel did not actively participate in any of these activities, but she was charged and tried and executed as well.
So my understanding is that the government knew she was innocent.
Well, you know, that's one of the mysteries of the case. It's certainly, if you look at the FBI files, she is constantly referred to as cognizant and recalcitrant. That's the exact words. Never as guilty. And the CIA, in preparing questions to ask my father, because they presumed that rather than be executed, he would agree at the end to cooperate, one of the questions was your wife cognizant of your activities? Not was she involved, but did she even know about them? I'm convinced that Ethel did know about my father's activities, maybe not the details, but the general thread, and was supportive of them. But I don't think she actively participated in them. So when you take a look at the FBI files and the CIA files and you put it all together, it's pretty strong evidence that the government knew that Ethel was not guilty, but that they held her as a hostage to coerce my father. And when they, you know, when my father refused to cooperate, then they went ahead with her threat. With their threat to kill her. And you know, this is, that's probably one of the most shocking things about my parents' case. Not only that they did this, but that we know they did this.
Wow. So it sounds, and we're going to, one of the things that ties this together is the idea of lynching, tying together Billie Holiday with her song Strange Fruit, and which was about lynching, and what happened to your parents, which was seemed to be a legal lynching, and they both would have been 100 years old in the year 2015. Mm-hmm. Now, Billie Holiday was just 44 when she died. What were the circumstances around her death?
Well, I'm going to step back a little bit and perhaps jump ahead, but I just, you know, there is this point of convergence that actually occurs in that Billie Holiday was a very precocious young singer. Before the age of 20, she was already recording in Harlem. She was already making a name for herself. And she became a featured singer at a club in Greenwich Village named Cafe Society. Now, Cafe Society was run by, owned by a member of the American Communist Party named Barney Josephson. And Barney set up this nightclub in part to make a political statement, and that is, it was the only integrated nightclub in Manhattan at the time. It was called the right place for the right kind of place for the wrong kind of people.
Uh-huh.
It made fun of the elite, and yet it attracted the elite because it was such a phenomenon. And Billy sang there, and Abel Meeropol, my adoptive father, wrote the words and music of a song, "Strange Fruit," in the late 1930s, and he presented it to Billie Holiday. He played it for her, and she was convinced by the owner to sing it, and it became an immediate sensation. Now, that's how the connection all got made, and Billie, in singing this song, "Strange Fruit," it didn't go down easy. To have this song that talked about, passionate or pastoral scene of the gallant South, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh, then the sudden smell of burning flesh. The idea of black bodies being the strange fruit of these trees, and Southerners gathering in huge mobs and having picnics to view lynchings, bringing their kids to these lynchings as a festivity. That to publicize that and to present it as basically saying these are despicable people doing despicable things. Well, that was totally unacceptable to many people in the South who saw themselves as genteel and civilized, and to be attacked in this manner was they couldn't handle it. And literally there were riots, and there were powerful forces within the United States government that said, wait a second, this attack on lynching is making us look bad. We better stop these people from doing this. It's all part of a communist plot to destroy the American way of life. And so the response to the song was immediate and powerful, and it got Billy in a lot of trouble.
Wow. I hadn't known all that. That's fascinating. We're going to play the song in just a second. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Robert Meeropol, who is head of the Rosenberg Fund for Children. We're talking about the convergence of Billie Holiday and his birth mother, Ethel Rosenberg. So let's hear this offending song about lynchings in the South. This is Billie Holiday.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South, the bulging eyes and twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here's a strange and bitter cry.
Wow. That will never not be haunting and very, very effective. The next song plays there. So it seems, Robert Mirapol, that both women, they raised issues. They rubbed the law the wrong way, I guess. What was it about law and law enforcement which both your mother, Ethel Rosenberg, and Billie Holiday experienced?
Well, we'll start with Billie. She sang the song, and it got there was a lot of negative response. There was also a lot of positive response.
I bet.
You have to understand that. It was, and Billie Holiday was at the height of her career, and it was an incongruous song in a way for her to sing, because mostly she sang love songs. And so she was incredibly popular, and then there was this one singing these songs that kind of were feel-good songs, and then you had this strange fruit out there. And so the powers that be tried to get her to stop singing it. She was actually told by one of the committees, I'm not sure if it was the House Un-American Activities Committee in her case, to stop singing it, but it was that kind of pressure was put on her, and she said, no, I'm not going to stop singing it. There's nothing wrong with this song. I'm going to keep singing it. And so she was also, as often as could have happened in that time with a lot of performers, she became addicted to heroin. And law enforcement found out about this, and in the cases, you know, I would say it was a case of selective prosecution. Mm. There were other performers, particularly white Hollywood performers, who, you know, had drug and alcohol issues, and those were kind of swept under the rug at those points, because they were too big to be jailed. Mm. But with Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit, they came right after her, and she was arrested for drug possession in 1948, I believe it was, and she was spent a year in prison. And that prison sentence haunted her for the rest of her career. In fact, it impeded her career, and it might have been one of the reasons for the sentence, because when you are convicted of a felony in federal court, as she was, you could not... there was a law in the books that said you couldn't sing in a club that served alcohol.
Yeah.
So she was confined in her singing to certain venues. And, of course, you know, not being able to sing in clubs was devastating
sure.
to her. So that's Billie's story. And ultimately, she was... she continued to perform, and she was making somewhat of a comeback through the 1950s, though Strange Fruit was not getting any play during the McCarthy period. It was, It was just nobody was recording it, and hardly anybody was singing it. But she was singing other songs, and she became ill. Her body could not take the abuse that she was putting it through with her addiction. And she was hospitalized with a drug-related malady. And there she was served papers for a new arrest for drug possession. Yeah. So she died in her hospital bed at the age of 44, awaiting a new arraignment on a second drug charge. So she was hounded to her death, you could say. Now, Ethel Rosenberg was a somewhat different story. When we're talking about similar talents, Ethel had a very powerful singing voice. In fact, she was used to be called out of her regular classes when she was a lower classman in high school to sing at the senior, at the upper class assembly. She would, the irony is that she would be called upon to sing the national anthem at school and assemblies.
Wow, really?
She wanted to be a singer and an actress, but she graduated high school at the height of the Depression.
Right.
And all she could get was a job in the garment district. And like Billy, she was precocious. She graduated high school at 15. And by the time she was 19, she helped lead a strike of garment workers in 1934. And so she was getting in trouble as a left-wing activist. She ultimately joined the Communist Party, married Julius Rosenberg, and the FBI and the federal government arrested her in order to coerce Julius. So she was, as I said before, held as a hostage. So she was a victim of law enforcement who was trying to use her to coerce cooperation from her husband. So there were ulterior motives related to power in both cases,
yes,
of both Ethel and Billy. And of course, Ethel was then executed at the age of 37.
Yes.
And to sort of bring the story around, after Ethel's execution, Abel Meeropol was one of her pallbearers of her coffin. So the person who wrote the song Strange Fruit that got Billy in trouble, Billy was still alive at this point in the early 1950s, 14 years later, after Billy first sang that song, he ended up carrying the coffin of a woman who he at least would have believed was legally lynched. So that's kind of how it all comes together. And I'm not sure that I've been talking long enough, so I'm not sure exactly what your question was, but I hope I answered it.
Oh, absolutely. The convergence of both. It's really amazing. And how the person who wrote the song Strange Fruit adopted you. And, mm-hmm. and
yeah. And that's, when you think about it, the whole thing about lynching in the South, I think that the times in which Billy was singing this song, we had hundreds of people being lynched every year.
Right.
Okay. This went on, and it wasn't just the Deep South. There were lynchings that occurred in Bob Dylan's song "Desolation Row," which is not one of his more famous songs. Starts off with they're selling postcards of the hanging. Well, that is a description of an incident that he observed, he didn't observe, he wasn't alive yet, but that occurred not far from where he grew up in northern Minnesota, in Duluth, in the 1930s, when there was a depression and there weren't enough jobs to go around, and the circus came to town.
Mm-hmm.
There were black circus people who were doing the putting up and painting, taking down of the tents. And they were dubbed to be taking jobs away from white people. And so they were lynched. And photographs were taken of this and distributed widely to make it clear to black people that they weren't welcome doing work in Duluth. So lynching was nationwide, and it was a terrorization of an entire population, and beyond that, as involving tens of thousands of people in these large gatherings. I mean, some lynchings took place in the middle of the night and weren't, you know, public events, but others were major public events. And the people who went to these things brought their children. Some of these children, you know, who were, let's say this occurred in 1935, these kids were born in 1925. Well, they'd be 90 years old today. But they then raised another generation of children. And what, you know, what did they teach their kids? Did they talk about these things? Is this part of their tradition? How does all of this relate to the way black people are treated today in this country? You know, it was part of our culture. And when certain people tried to introduce anti-lynching bills in Congress in the 1930s, they never passed. You know, you couldn't get the Congress of the United States to declare lynching illegal.
Right.
Think about that.
Even
so, this is powerful.
Even FDR, who was, I mean, certainly a liberal, it's kind of the classic liberal, he, in order to get his New Deal passed, he couldn't dare risk offending the Southern senators, so he didn't push the anti-lynching law. It's so,
and they were all Democrats then.
Oh,
this was before LBJ's, you know, Civil Rights Act that shifted all these people into the Republican Party, ultimately where they are today.
Yes, where they are today. And I don't know if Billie Holiday ever actually saw a lynching, but it was certainly well known in her lifetime. Both Ethel Rosenberg and Billie Holiday were born in 1915, so they grew up in the Great Depression, where there was, you know, a lot of tremendous tension, and the lynchings were absolutely going on. And there was also back then, you know, such desperation. The Communist Party had a lot of appeal to an awful lot of Americans. And I assume this is when your parents became communists. I mean, nobody else was talking about Social Security. Nobody else was talking about ending racism and ending lynching aside from the communists.
And the Communist Party actively recruited within the African American community as part of their anti-racist belief system. And actively campaigned for the anti-lynching law.
So,
and that, you know, looking at my parents' politics in the 1930s, they both grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in extreme poverty. People who knew Ethel Rosenberg in high school, years ago, one woman told me, and this was decades ago now, that they were so poor that walking to high school, they used to stuff newspaper in their shoes because their shoes had holes in them and the snow would get into them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the and sometimes they went to bed hungry. They couldn't find, you know, the kids. There
reality,
wasn't enough
yeah.
food. It was that desperate. And so they grew up in that atmosphere, and they grew up on the Lower East Side, where the Communist Party was a major political force. There was actually a communist elected from that area to the New York City Council. So it was not like some sort of far out one in a million kind of thing. It was a large percentage of the population, and one of the reasons the communists were so popular was because people would look out their windows during the Depression, and they would see that there were all these families crowded into tenement houses, and they couldn't afford the rent because they had no work. And so the landlords, who wanted their rent and wanted to rent out the apartments, would send goon squads in to remove the people's furniture, throw it in the streets, change the locks, and lock them out of their apartments. Well, that was going on a regular basis, and the Communist Party organized squads of young people to wait until darkness fell, go then break the locks, and move the furniture back in.
Yep.
So Ethel and Julius looked out their windows, and they saw the capitalists and the landlords as the enemy, and they saw the communists as their heroes. And, you know, they had this from their own experience.
Of course.
And beyond that, if they went to a demonstration like in Union Square, they would then, you know, there'd be a peaceful demonstration, and the cops would come in with their horses and batons and beat people and break up the demonstration. And the next day they'd read in the newspapers that the communist riots and the police restored order. You know, and so they knew with their own eyes, they knew from their own experience that the press lied about communism and that the communists were heroes. So it makes perfect sense that in this kind of atmosphere, more than a million Americans at one point or another entered the Communist Party between 1932 and 1950. And at the end of the Second World War, where we'd been allied with a communist nation, and all of a sudden they were the arch enemy,
right.
Having this communist sympathy throughout the country was not politically acceptable. So one of the ways to destroy the Communist Party was to put Communist Party members on trial for stealing the greatest secrets known to mankind and threatening our existence and saying, you know, the communists are going to drop an atomic bomb on New York City, and it's all because of what Ethel and Julius Rosenberg and other Communist Party members did. And it worked very well. It effectively, right. It was part of the destruction of the Communist Party.
And
that's how that connects.
It does indeed. And you mentioned terrorizing. It's, you know, to keep a population down. My old college professor, as I'm sure regular listeners have heard before, said politics is the economy of violence. You don't need to see it all the time. But to have something incredibly violent, like the horses going in and beating on people and things like that. Obviously, that was before the days of body cameras, which is, you know, it's making a difference these days. I mean, we talk about lynching. We talk about police shooting unarmed black men. Obviously, this is not something that is limited to the 1930s or the 1950s. This lynching stuff, you know, that may be not as public. It may not be a festivity anymore, like a picnic kind of thing. But it's still kind of going on. And I wonder about, I mean, that explains your parents' left background. My father, who was, well, a year older than Ethel, he certainly described the Depression the very same way with the newspapers and the shoes, etc. But Billie Holiday, I mean, I imagine, I can't take for granted, but, you know, most black people at the time didn't have a lot of money. And I wonder if she was political. Is it known, or was the determination to perform that song, Strange Fruit, really just related to the unique subject matter of the song, you know, the lynching?
You know, this is something I'm not really sure about.
Okay.
What my understanding of Billie Holiday was that she was a terrific singer,
yes.
Performer. She wasn't particularly political, but she said that she had personal experience of lynching. Not that she necessarily had an immediate relative lynched. But the fact of the matter is that Billie, particularly in her later years, told a lot of different stories, and sometimes they were contradictory. So it's not clear to me exactly, you know, what is real and what is not real. But there was, you know, this. I think that her reaction to Strange Fruit, her understanding of it, and her singing of it was very political, but also very visceral. It was an act of resistance, and it's the thing I want to emphasize about Strange Fruit and I want to emphasize this because it's often been described as a mournful lament, and that characterization really bothers me because it's not a lament. I think there's almost a willful refusal to listen and to hear what is actually being said to characterize it that way. The song is an attack. It's an attack against the perpetrators of lynching. And Abel Meeropol said in an interview in 1971, "I wrote Strange Fruit because I hate lynching and I hate the people who perpetrate lynching." you know, this was not a love, you know, turn the other cheek kind of song. This was an attack. And that's what offended the opposition so much. And of course, this kind of verbal attack is almost irrefutable. I mean, there was, what could you say to this but resort to violence?
That's one thing about art and artists. They can do things oftentimes that other people in regular speech can't get away with, and it's still exceptionally powerful. We think of works of art, Guernica and others, that disturb the peace, shall we say, and that tell the truth where others can't do it. How did the public react when that song, Strange Fruit, came out?
The song first was performed in 39.
Oh, wow. Long time
ago. It was 48 when she was arrested. Well, it depends upon which public you're talking about.
Yeah, that's true.
If you're talking about the people who rioted, well, that you've got your reaction there.
Yeah.
But within cafe society, the first it's quite remarkable when it was first performed. Barney Josephson decided that he was going to stage it in a very dramatic way. It was going to be the final song of the set. The whole stage was going to go black. And then a spot would be put on Billy, and she would sing the song, and then the set would be over. Well, when she sang the song, when it was done, there was silence. The audience was stunned. That's the way it was described. And then one person clapped, and then there was a standing ovation. And and that was kind of standard. It was always performed in that manner. And it was oftentimes met with stunned silence and then prolonged applause. So, I mean, that just shows the power of it. And one of the things that is remarkable about Strange Fruit, and your listeners have heard the song which you played, is it's under 100 words long.
Yeah, very short.
It's 97 words. And, you know, I don't want to, you know, promote cliches, the pen is mightier than the sword.
Well,
but this demonstrates, these 97 words don't necessarily demonstrate that the pen is mightier than the sword, but it shows that it can be. And that in this case, in some ways, it has been.
And if you think about it, the black people in the South, I can't imagine the courage it would take to launch a protest against lynching. Because you'd be lynched yourself, and the whole point was to terrorize people. So obviously, lynching worked and terrorizing people. But here's this black woman artist, and what can you do? What can you do about that? Tremendous power, absolutely huge power. I wonder, how did law enforcement react when it first came out? Did it come out on a record fairly soon thereafter?
Well, they did. Well, first of all, Billie Holiday was a Columbia recording artist, and Columbia refused to record it.
Really?
So she went to Commodore Records, which also had a sort of old lefty owner. I don't know that he was a communist, but he was a left winger. And they recorded it and released it, and it was a B-side record. And it became very popular, but lots of radio stations refused to play it. And, of course, law enforcement attacked Billy for singing it because the song created disturbances. So blame the song, not the people who were rioting. So that's when they began to shadow her, and that was their excuse for shadowing her. And, you know, that security is often used as an excuse. We have to be secure. This is a dangerous situation. So all of a sudden, law enforcement are watching Billy's every move. And of course, it's not too long before they discover that they can get her on a drug charge, and they do. I want to step forward a little bit. You mentioned body cameras before, and I think one of the things that we have to recognize after all the lynching that took place and all the brutality the terror that was rained upon African American communities in this nation, that it never really ended. That mass imprisonment, the imprisonment of 2 million Americans, the war on drugs, which was designed to sweep through neighborhoods of poor people, mostly people of color.
Absolutely.
You know, we know from all the statistics that drug use among white American teenagers is pretty much the same as among black American teenagers. But somehow it's the black American teenagers who all end up in prison, and the whites, by and large, don't. And so we have this basic trajectory that is a common history that goes right down from lynching to mass incarceration. And we now know from the main change that's occurred in the last couple of years is all of a sudden all this stuff is being filmed, and it's being filmed in a graphic manner, and it did happen to get publicized at a time when you had an African-American president who said something about it and an African-American attorney general who said something about it. And all of a sudden, these kinds of things become, quote-unquote, newsworthy.
Right.
They weren't newsworthy before, but now we have all this graphic evidence. And as we see it over and over and over again, you know, one of the things that's a common threat to all of this is people saying, well, you know, all, the average law enforcement, the vast majority of police are honest and doing their jobs, but they're just a few bad apples who do this and give us a bad name. Well, no, that's not the case.
Right.
This is endemic to police departments. It doesn't mean that everybody does it, but the way they've gotten away with doing this kind of thing is that there's a core of people who are involved. I don't know what the percentage is. I imagine it's a significant minority.
Absolutely.
And then the rest of the people look the other way.
Mm-hmm.
So they collude in it.
Right.
And so when you put those two things together, you've got a systemic problem that has its roots in lynching and has its roots in African-American oppression. And it's not going to go away. I mean, body cameras are going to produce more evidence. Of course, now there's a move to keep what's shown on the body camera secret. Of course, that's exactly what they want to do.
Oh, absolutely.
But you know, it is a helpful move, but I think we've got it's a much deeper problem than that.
And I think Robbie Meeropol, what we're talking about here is the fact that, I mean, if you ask any black American about this situation with, you know, suddenly there's one after the other of white officers killing unarmed black men. They've known about it for decades. It's no surprise to African Americans at all. But white Americans have been, as you said, protected from it. I mean, there's the perpetrators for sure, and then there's the wall of silence around it. You know, the people who go to the festivities, the people who have a picnic at the lynchings. They didn't actually, you know, do the lynching themselves, but And the law enforcement and protecting the police, assuming innocent. That's been going on for quite some time. And it seems to me like Billie Holiday was very, very early in daring to call attention to that. It's quite a remarkable thing. You know, there was the whole Jim Crow world back then in the early to mid 20th century that, you know, it happened a lot. And then there's the what happened to your parents. It seems in some kind of ways, I mean, you know, of course, the Russians, the Soviets couldn't come up with a nuclear bomb on their own. Somebody had to sneak it to them, right? Because we're exceptional here. Was that some kind of a lynching, do you think? I mean, we're talking about lynching so much. Did your parents get lynched by the law?
Well, I think that if you look at my father's case, in which he was actually providing information to the Soviet Union, I would call, you know, he was guilty of something. And frankly, if he had been sentenced to 5 or 10 years in prison for what he did, I would have little complaints. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, of course, the American system tends to oversentence just about everybody. So my guess is if he would have been sentenced to more than 5 or 10 years. But since he did something, and he, you know, could, if he'd been processed by the law in a reasonable and fair manner, it wouldn't have been a lynching. I would say that in terms of the execution was, it wasn't a lynching in one sense, and that is that the government and the FBI admitted this after my parents were killed. They didn't really want to kill them. The death sentence was used to coerce them into saying what the government wanted them to say. Mm. Now, when you look at the typical African-American lynching, you couldn't, you know, if you were about to be lynched, you couldn't get up there and make a speech and say, okay, I admit I did this, that, and the other thing, and therefore don't lynch me, and then they would just cart you off to jail. That never happened. Mm-hmm. You were dead. That was it. In my parents' case, if my father had come out and said, yeah, I stole the secret of the atomic bomb, and here are the people who did it with me, he would have gone to prison. He wouldn't have been executed. But Ethel was someone, her case was a lynching in the sense that the government pretty much, it's pretty clear the government knew that she didn't steal the atomic secrets. They just executed her as a hostage to coerce my father. And so by executing someone who was not guilty of the crime and knowing pretty much that they were not, and I have to use the word pretty much because, you know, the right wing in sort of, dealing with my parents' case presumes to know what was going on inside of my parents' minds. I mean, even to the extent that they've said things like, well, okay, maybe they didn't steal valuable atomic secrets now that we have the record, but they would have if they could have.
Yeah.
You know, well, that's good. Maybe these people have ESP. So I don't know exactly what was going on in the government's mind.
Well, but
I'm fairly certain that they knew that Ethel didn't do what they were killing her for, and in that sense, it was a lynching.
Well, also, I mean, if you think about what, you know, lynching of blacks in the South and what the message they were trying to get to both African Americans as well as communists or people of the left was, don't you dare do anything about it. You better be scared. And to help, you know, pump up the racism and pump up the attacks on left-leaning Americans. And it worked really well. It worked really well.
Yeah, it did. And it was, there's also an element, I agree with you entirely, Bert, and I also think that there was an element of divide and conquer. I mean, one of the things that you see in the FBI files is we don't want the communists and the African Americans getting together. We want to, in the 1960s, we want to separate the civil rights movement from the anti-war movement. We don't want a grand coalition of the oppressed and dissenters.
Oh, yes.
And I think that, you know, that's something that we, those of us who are progressive and trying to bring about basic change in this country, fight to this day, because that division has been difficult to overcome.
Well, it certainly has, and it's well known that J. Edgar Hoover and lots of people tried to tie Martin Luther King, who's now revered, you know, whose the image is a little different from what the reality was, but they wanted to call him a communist so as to discredit the movement. What impact do you think the reaction to the song and the execution of your parents, what impact did that have on democracy itself in America, do you think?
Well, you know, I think that within the African-American community, I get into arguments with people, mostly people who are liberal as opposed to leftists, mm-hmm. who blame blacks for not voting, who blame the people of color for not voting. You know, I say if you look at what democracy has meant for these people, the inability to pass an anti-lynching law, the failure of the legal system to protect their rights, the abuse of the legal system to destroy their rights, when you put all of that together, you can see an alienation from the system which would lead reasonable people to say, this isn't worth it. you know, the deck stacked against us. We're not going to go participate in this activity. And, of course, that sort of alienation and failure to participate in the process played into the hands of those in power. But it also made sense, given that if you tried to participate in the process, you often, you know, got your head beaten in.
Right.
So it has a de-democratization, if I can make that word up.
Yes, absolutely.
It basically undermined the democratic process, and I think today, I think while there's certainly the case with in the local level that there's plenty of democracy, but the higher up you go the national system, the more the system is controlled by money and the media, and it is a democratic form of sorts, but it's not really a democracy. And of course, the disenfranchisement of massive numbers of poor people, and particularly African Americans, through mass incarceration and now changes in voting laws,
voter suppression, are
all part of the same process. And it's not an encouraging picture. I'm glad to see all this material coming out about police violence against African Americans and against, you know, anybody who crosses their path.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily the solution. It's just the beginning. If we can correct this, I would say this is the first step in what will be a long process.
And I wonder about, you know, there's a lot of renewed interest in the song Strange Fruit, in part because of the 100th anniversary of Billie Holiday's birthday. But I wonder about what you think about the song's recent resurgence as a counterpoint to its suppression during the McCarthy period. Is that something we should feel somewhat hopeful about?
Well, yeah. You know, looking at it personally, Abel Meeropol, Strange Fruit was Abel Meeropol's crowning moment. I mean, it was the work he was most proud of.
I'll bet.
But growing up in his household, I started living with him after my parents were killed. So 1954, we're talking about now. It's already 15 years after Billie Holiday first performed it. It had already been suppressed during the McCarthy period. It wasn't being performed much. Abel Meeropol was actually brought before a New York State anti-communist committee, the Rapkuder Committee, in 1940, and asked by the committee if the Communist Party ordered him to write the song, which I think is kind of funny. But he was very, you know, he was felt badly about how the song had been eclipsed. And I remember he used to say, he used to lament as he was getting older and beginning to lose his memory. Oh, I wish I could have done a little more for you boys. I wish Strange Fruit was being performed more. And then when Abel died in 1986, it was just beginning to be reborn. We began to see various other groups. There was a group in Britain that had reggae roots called UB40 that did a reggae version of it.
Wow.
Sting performed it in 1986 as part of a commemorative album to celebrate Amnesty International's 25th anniversary. It was performed a lot and sung a lot in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. Southern Trees Bear a Strange Fruit. They adopted the illusion. And then Cassandra Wilson, in her debut album, and she's a very famous blues singer, her album was a minor sensation, and she performed Strange Fruit, and she did it brilliantly. And then, to continue on, In the year 2000, Time magazine named it the song of the century.
Really?
In their retrospective on the 20th century. And then David Margolick wrote a book called Strange Fruit, Cafe Society, and an Early Cry for Civil Rights that sold very well. And then another documentary filmmaker named Joel Katz did a documentary, an hour-long documentary on the film Strange Fruit. And
so it lives.
It lived, and so it was bubbling, but really the resurgence occurred starting a couple of years ago in the most strange way of all, and that is Kanye West.
Really?
You know, the very popular artist.
Yeah.
Put Nina Simone's version singing Blood on the Leaves, Blood on the Leaves, behind a rap he did that was about something about complaining about how this ex-girlfriend was bringing him to court and he had to pay all this divorce attorney or something. I don't know. I don't know, remember the exact, but it was the kind of thing that would make Abel Meeropol turn over in his grave.
Yeah, well.
But all of a sudden, it was an internet sensation.
Well, absolutely.
And Kanye West's song was followed up by Audra McDonald singing it on Broadway, winning a Grammy for it.
So it still goes on. That's one thing about
these other people.
Yeah, art just continues. Art resonates with the human soul. That's what it did for Billie Holiday and, you know, the freedom, the trying to be alive that your mother had and the convergence. It's some powerful stuff. We didn't even get to talk about the Rosenberg Fund for Children. I urge listeners, check out rfc.org. It's an amazing, amazing organization.
Yes, www.rfc.org.
It helps kids whose parents are politically persecuted. The only one, anything like it. Thank you so much, Robert Meeropol.
Thank you for having me.
All right, and we're going to go out with a version of the song from 2010, Katie Segal.
Great, thank you.
Swinging in the southern